Hello, I'm Greg Johnston. Welcome to Imagining the Past, the 2023 season. HNSA acknowledges the traditional custodians of the land on which we work and live, and recognises their continuing connection to the land, water, and community. We pay respects to elders past, present, and emerging. The Historical Novel Society Australasia promotes the reading, writing and publishing of historical fiction through our biennial conferences and online programs. The ARA Historical Novel Prize is now the richest genre-based literary award in Australasia, a breathtaking $100,000 divided between the adult and CYA categories. Brian Faulkner is the award-winning best-selling author of more than 20 books for children and young adults. His books have been published in over 12 countries in 7 different languages. His novel, Carpe Del Joe, Wolf's Lair, the third part in the series, was shortlisted for the 2022 ARA Historical Novel CYA category. It's a great pleasure to welcome Brian to Imagining the Past.
It's great to be here. Thanks for inviting me along.
Well, it's good to have you here. When did you begin to think of yourself as a writer? I'm always interested in that.
Yeah, it depends what you mean by thinking of myself as a writer. Ever since I was a kid, I'm probably like 10 or 12, I always had this kind of dream of being a writer. I wouldn't say I thought of myself as being a writer back then. When my first book was published, which is going back to 2003, from that point on, I kind of did think of myself as a writer, but with a little bit of imposter syndrome. Like, do I really belong here with all these other writers? You know, did I just get lucky with my first book? So it took me quite a few years to really think, yeah, this is actually me. This is what I do.
So I would imagine it's a process of folding yourself into it in a way.
Absolutely right, yeah.
What kind of attracted you to junior fiction and CYA?
You know, I kind of fell into it, really. When I was writing, I was writing for years before I was ever published, and everything that I wrote was never accepted. I got a room full of rejection slips. And the first time I tried to write a book for young people, it got accepted. The story was I'd actually also been working on screenplays. I'd been trying to write some screenplays, and I had an idea for a screenplay about a 12-year-old boy who becomes a professional rugby league player in the NRL. And I wrote the screenplay and then decided I would try writing it into a novel. But because the main character was 12, therefore it pretty much had to be a junior fiction novel. So I wrote it as a junior fiction novel, sent it off to the publishers, and they accepted it.
Wow, that's inspiring.
It was almost an accident, really, if you see what I mean. I hadn't intended. I guess I found my zone. I found where I belonged. Now, yeah. That's where I belonged all the time. I just hadn't realized it until I accidentally fell into it.
Yeah, well, I think that underscores the need to push your boundaries a bit and also just experiment with things.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there could be writers out there who are busy trying to write picture books who should be writing romance novels until they try. They don't know.
So before we start speaking about Carpe Del Joe explicitly, I'm just wondering how many
I'm going to pick you up on the pronunciation.
Oh, okay.
As well get that right from the start, and then we've got it right throughout. Now, if you said catapo, you'd be close enough that nobody would be offended. If you wanted to say it correctly, which is slightly difficult, so I think we'll probably stick with catapo for the sake of this podcast, but because it's a Māori word from New Zealand, it's ka te pō. But I think catapo is a generally accepted pronunciation, even in New Zealand. It's not a correct pronunciation, but it's what a lot of people would say. So let's just go with catapo.
All right. Well, I'll try ka te pō.
Very good. Very good.
Well, very good orally. before we do start to talk about the book, I'm just wondering how many words it is, because it's quite a hefty book.
Yeah, from memory, without going back and counting them, I would say I think it's 86,000 words. So that's a reasonably hefty novel. I mean, we're not talking Harry Potter length.
No, it's
novel,
true.
Are we?
But
You know, the doorstop type novel. Actually, to put it in context, because it does look like a hefty novel. So that's at 85,000. That is pretty much the length of the second Harry Potter book, Harry Potter,
right.
Chamber of Secrets. The first Harry Potter was 77. So I'm slightly over Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone, but you're coming in around the Chamber of Secrets.
Of the nine long-listed books for the ARA Historical Novel Prize CYA category 2022, four were set in World War II. I'm just wondering, what's that telling us?
I don't know. If I had to stab at it and had to have a guess at it, I'd say that, like myself, there's a lot of writers who have a great interest in that time period, which may reflect on the age of the writers more than anything else. I mean, if the writers who'd been selected were 20 years old, they might be writing about completely different things. Or it might be that that time period to the average reader today still feels like history, recent but not too recent history. And if you're writing about the 1990s, it doesn't quite feel historical, even although technically it is, because it's, you know, 20, 30 years ago.
Well, by our definition that we use for the prize, it's 50 years. So
there you go. So it's not historical.
Yeah. So we're up to whatever it is, 73 now. So
So Vietnam War would come in as historical. Yeah. Mm. But I think also, and this is probably what attracts me to that era. And I grew up not long after, well, 20 years after the end of that war, but it was recent, very recent history when I was growing up. The Second World War was this great shadow, this great stain on our history that wasn't that long ago. Now it's nearly, you know, getting on towards 100 years ago. And I think it's sort of further away. It's disappearing into the distance, if you
like. Yeah, I agree. But I don't think I kind of had that realization till years later when I first heard about it at school and learned things at school. It seemed very distant and very long ago. But then as I got older, I just kind of thought, wow, you know, that was 15 years before I was born. It finished.
It wasn't that long.
Yeah, no, well,
it was pretty close.
And of course, blink of an eye.
Yeah, and the other thing about the Second World War, which probably appeals to the other authors as well as to myself, is that it had such an effect on the world that we live in today. Even the conflict in Ukraine that's happening at the moment, you can trace the roots of that directly back to the Second World War. So, you know, it's a massive impact on our current world. So I think that's why it's quite interesting to examine, you know, the roots of the current situation.
Yeah. So what was the first idea you had of Joe? Because it's quite a long adventure when you think it's over three books. So what was kind of, how did you kind of arrive at the story?
Yeah, it's an interesting one. The original, I suppose, germ of the idea came, I was watching a movie, a Second World War movie called A Bridge Too Far. It's a story of Operation Market Garden. Now, it starts off with a Dutch boy who is spying on the Germans in Holland. And watching that, and I saw this boy who ends up dying in the movie. And he's about 14 years old. And I thought, what would it have been like to have been that age and to be doing these kinds of things, to actually be operating as a spy, knowing you could be killed at any moment, you know, in this kind of a conflict? And so that sparked the idea of writing about a spy during World War II, a 14-year-old or a teenage spy during the Second World War. But the other part of that whole equation was that there's a lot of sort of spy kids type stories out there. And I'm not knocking them in any way. I love those kinds of stories. Teenage spy stories with gadgets and gimmicks and James Bond Jr. sort of things. And I wanted to write the opposite to that. I wanted to write about a real kid of a certain age in very real situations. No gadgets, unless they were actual gadgets that they genuinely had at that time. No gimmicks, and just, you know, what would it have been like to be a boy in that time? And that's ended up with the concept for Katapult Joe.
So it's the third part, the one that I've read and that was in the prize is the third part of the series. Mm-hmm. Did you kind of have the whole thing planned out before you started, or did you just do the first one and then add on from there?
Yeah, so something in between those two things. I had the concept for the first book and then the concept that there would be a series and that we would follow the main character, Joe, through different events of the Second World War. So when I finished the first book, then what I would do is look up the major events of, say, the next 12 months and decide what I could involve him in that time period. And for the third book, it basically was Operation Barbarossa, the invasion of Russia. So that's where we were at in the timeline of the series. Now, if we carried the series on, you know, there's other opportunities to involve him in different things. And it was really a case of saying, how can I involve this character in those situations? But also knowing that there are certain threads that would be running through. The connection with Adolf Hitler is one of them. And that was teed up in the very first book. That in the first book, I mean, I'm not sure you may not have read the first book, but in the first book, when Joe's very young, I think he's 10 years old at the start of that book, and he's living in Berlin with his family, which is why he is a native Berlin speaker. He's a New Zealand kid, but he's grown up in Berlin, native, speaks German like a native. And he has a dog. He has a small Alsatian puppy, which his mother, he wanted to name the dog after some American movie star. The name just escapes me at the moment. His mother wouldn't let him do it. So he ended up calling the dog Blondie. Now, when he had to escape from Berlin, when his father was arrested, he had to leave the dog behind. And his best friend took the dog. His best friend was the nephew of Martin Bormann. His family ended up giving this puppy named Blondie to Martin Bormann. Martin Bormann was Hitler's private secretary. Martin Bormann gave the dog to Hitler. So Hitler ends up with an Alsatian puppy called Blondie. Now, if you know your history, you'll know that Adolf Hitler did have an Alsatian called Blondie. So I've created this fictional backstory for how he got the dog. But then that let me tie that in to certain key scenes in the story. There's a scene where Joe actually meets Hitler. And Blondie, the dog, is there. Blondie comes bounding over to Joe, jumps on him, up on him, and starts licking him, and you know, giving him a dog cuddle. And of course, it's because this is his first owner. But Hitler doesn't know that, and Hitler just assumes that Blondie is a very good judge of character, and therefore Joe must be a good person, not knowing that Joe is there spying on him.
That's a great trope to use. So, was it difficult to make all the novels stand alone, or did you? I mean, there were some things in Wolf's Lair that I felt a bit at sea with, and I kind of felt like I should have, you know, possibly read the first two. But I mean, it is a standalone novel, but that always seems to be quite a difficult thing to do to me in a series.
Look, it is intended to be read as a series. You've come into Wolf's Lair without knowing Joe's history, his backstory, his relationship with Sophie, which is explored in the second book. And not understanding that would take away a lot of the depth of the third book. But I would like it to be able to be read as a standalone novel, but I would much prefer that people read the three novels in sequence and, you know, really understood what was going on. I mean, to try and create another example, if you came into, say, Game of Thrones in book three, you know, without understanding all about Ned and what had happened in the in, you know, their first book, you really not understand what's going on at all.
So, no, you would be really at sea with that.
Totally.
But Joe's like, I mean, you've kind of touched on this, but Joe is, you know, he's incredibly able and insightful, and he's incredibly well-versed in espionage. I'm just wondering if there was a danger when you were writing to kind of tip him over into almost a superhero.
Well, I tried very hard not to, because I didn't want him to be James Bond or Spy Kids Ryder? You know, one of the sort of gadgety type spy. And again, I love those books. I'm not knocking them. I'm just trying to do something different to them. So I didn't want that. The whole fact of what he's capable of with the spy stuff that he knows. In the first book, you see him learn it. He goes to training with Hitler's secret army. And he goes to, he has weapons training, and he goes through this whole process of going from this very innocent teenage boy to who he is by book three, and which is also affected by the things he goes through, the missions that he's been on, things that have happened to him. All of those have affected the character. So by the time you get to book three, he is a, you know, pretty decent spy, but he's certainly not in book one.
Right. Okay. Well, that again is you need to read them all in sequence.
That's my recommendation. Yeah.
You've touched on this as well, but you've placed your fictional characters in a fairly tightly rendered historical settings. I'm just wondering what the risks were with that, you know, that you've put these fictional characters into, you know, an historical situation.
Well, for a start, there is a very valid, I believe, a very valid reason for rendering the historical aspects so accurately. And I may have made mistakes, but I've done my best to be really accurate and to render it as closely as I could. A lot of research, a lot of books from people, you know, written by people who were there, Hitler's bodyguard, Hitler's valet, Hitler's secretary, reading all these things, trying to get a feeling for what it was actually like. Books about being in the Blitz, because the first book is partly set during the Blitz. So, and the reason for doing that is because I've created the central conceit, this character who does not exist. I made this character up. To make Joe seem real, I've blanketed him with actual reality. So the more that the world around him is rendered correctly and historically authentically, then the more Joe seems to soak up some of that authenticity into his own character and seems like more of a real character. So that's the reason for doing it. So the original question was, I've digressed there, haven't I?
Oh, no, just that was it risky to do that, or did you kind of get to points where you felt like you had to pull back a bit?
Yeah, I don't think I ever felt like that. I was very concerned about including Hitler as a character in the third book. He's briefly mentioned in the second book. Joe actually does meet him, but in the third book, Hitler is a character. Now, that's a scary thing to do. But there was, you know, I wanted to do this. I wanted to create a persona for Hitler based on as accurate a picture as I could paint of him, based on all the people that knew him, that wrote books about him, because I needed Joe to meet this guy. And the reason for doing this, I think it's actually said in the introduction to, I think it's this book, it might be the first one. But it says that, you know, we can't just think of these people as being monsters. We have to, you know, accept these were human beings.
Yeah, I agree.
If we don't do that, then we just say, oh, he's a monster.
Yeah, it's too easy. It's far too easy.
Right, absolutely. So that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to create a character and paint him as a human being who did monstrous things, so that we can hopefully, you know, it helps people understand. And, you know, maybe we don't do it again. Although, in actual fact, of course, it keeps happening, doesn't it? I've dug up the actual quote that I was trying to get to before. That it was actually in the introduction to the second book in the series. So this is Catapodro Spycraft. And so this is the actual quote from the beginning. He says, "I've been accused of whitewashing the Nazi leadership in my memoirs. Some people say I make them seem human, but therein lies the problem. I saw these men up close. They were human. If we think of them only as monsters and demons, we may lose sight of the fact that they were very much like you and I. They had the same number of eyes, ears, and limbs. If we forget what humans are capable of, we risk it happening all over again."
Mm.
So that's a quote from old Joe. So as you will be aware, Joe's memoirs are sprinkled through the book. So we know that Joe survives, gets to be an old man, writes his memoirs, and excerpts from those memoirs sort of illustrate the chapters of the books. So that's a quote from his memoirs.
Yeah, I was going to discuss that later, but I just, with the research for the book, I'm always interested in your processes around that. And if you had some really great moments or bad moments, you know, where you found something that you really needed or found something that contradicted you.
Yeah, mostly the good stuff. Serendipity. You know, you need something to be a certain way, and you start doing research, and then you find out that it was that way, that there was something that's absolutely perfect for what you need. A very small example, it's not one of the big ones, but the only one I can think of off the top of my head is that it's book two. No, it's book three. I think it's book three. No, it's book two. I'm getting confused. No, it's book two. The I needed the main characters, this Joe and his friends, to meet somewhere. And I wanted to have something a little bit unusual, a little bit something sort of sounded real, but maybe wasn't real. Anyway, a little bit of research, and in Berchtesgaden, where Hitler did, he actually conducted most of the war from Berchtesgaden in Bavaria, from Uwe Salzburg, and in his house that was also his office there, in the basement of that house, there was a bowling alley, a one-lane 10-pin bowling alley. And a little bit of research. I even found pictures of Hitler bowling in that bowling alley. Mm-hmm. And as soon as I found that I had the place that I needed for the scene. So the kids are actually in the basement of the house bowling while some sort of heavy-duty conflict is going on. But it was just the perfect location. And I would never have, you know, would have made that up, because I would have thought people won't believe me. In fact, and I included photos, and there's a lot of in the back of the book, there's a lot of stuff, you know, proving what's real and what's not real. Mm-hmm. And I included some photos I found of it in the book, just so that people would know I didn't make it up.
So you've written these three in present tense, and but third person. Mm-hmm. I'm always interested in about the decisions about selecting the point of view and the tense that you're working in. What kind of process did you go through with that?
Yeah, it's something I discuss a lot with my students. You know, I run writing courses and writing camps, and I always have big discussions about the tense and the person. So the tense, if we start with that, the present tense, I feel adds an immediacy. You know, it's like, this is happening now. It's not I'm telling you a story about something that happened a while ago. This is happening. This is happening to me now. In the first book, incidentally, the first third, I think, of the book, which is when Joe is 10 years old and growing up in Germany as a young boy, that's written in past tense. Because in the nature of Joe as a teenager, that is history, that is older. So I wrote that and kept that in past tense. The memoirs, of course, are written in past tense. So it's a contrast, really, between the older Joe's memoirs and the younger Joe experiencing things as they are happening. And that was the reason for choosing the present tense. As for the person, third person had to be, because there are other points of view. Now, there are books, and I've read quite a few books, where you switch between first person chapters and third person chapters. I don't like them. I think you're either first person or you are third person. And I find it really confusing if you switch between, anyway, I'm sorry if you've done this in your books, but I personally, that's what I find is confusing. So if I'm going to write first person, it's going to be first person all the way through, which excludes any point of view other than the main character. So
I mean, jerking a reader around, you've got to have a lot of reasons to do that, I think. And it is discombobulating often.
Because I find it that way, I can't write the other way. So I've got to do what feels right for me, and feels right for me, you're either first or you're third. And if you're first, you can't have other points of view. And I just needed them. I needed them in the story.
So the characters are speaking German, and in the novels, and it's 1940s German at that, but you've had to render it all in English, obviously. I'm just wondering about the kinds of decisions you made around that. For example, Bormann uses Gunner and Warner at one point. So what's that saying about his German? Was he using High German or Low German? Because that's another thing we don't have in English.
Well, I don't think it's quite either. Bormann in real life was a very coarse character. If you read all the historical facts about him, he was known as like a very rough character. Someone, he was kind of from the fields, I guess, as I think somebody described him as. So he was very coarse in his manner. Now, because I'm writing this book in English, but I needed to hear his voice in my head, I actually chose, I'm trying to think of the actor's name, Ray Windsor? Is it Ray? I think that's the name. He's a British actor. He's a Cockney, I think. No, not Ray Windsor. Roy Windsor?
Not sure, sorry.
Oh, okay. I'll have to look him up later. Anyway, he's a really well-known British actor, and he plays these really rough characters. He does it with a Cockney accent. So in my head, when I was hearing Borman, I was actually hearing Ray Winds. No, it's not his name. Whatever his name is. Well, I was hearing his voice saying things. And that's the way he would speak. So that's the, the voice of the character became an sort of coarse English accent rather than a coarse German accent, which I really wouldn't have been able to render because the book's in English.
Yeah, it does create so many difficulties when you're using your set in a European language, you know, particularly when it has formal tenses, which really do demarcate a whole range of things that we can't do so easily in English. It's quite a difficult thing, quite a lot of decisions to make. You've talked about the fact that you've got
Ray Winstone. So if we Google some video clips of Ray Winstone, you'll know the kind of characters that he plays, and that's the kind of voice that I wanted. He also actually looks slightly like Martin Borman, so it helped me when I was writing the character. Well, anyway, sorry, just digressing there. Anyway,
invaluable information nonetheless. Yeah. You've kind of talked about the fact that you've peppered other kind of types of text through the novel by a journalist, by Adolf as well. Yep. Mm-hmm. And there's Joe's memoir. I was kind of surprised you did that because it, as you've said, it gives away the fact that Joe survives. Mm-hmm. So I was a bit kind of surprised that it took the tension out because I always knew Joe was going to survive. I'm just wondering what your thinking was around doing that.
Yeah, again, it's something I discussed with my writing students. Now, you'll know the book The Hunger Games. You know the main character is Katniss Everdeen. You know, she goes into an arena where the 24 kids all have to kill each other. And, of course, the central question of the novel is Katniss going to survive? You know, there's a book two and there's a book three. What do you think? It's kind of generally with the stories like this, you know, the main character is going to survive. I don't think anybody's ever fooled by that. Very few exceptions. The main character in a story like this is going to survive. So I started with the fact that the reader already knew that. So I couldn't really put Joe in any danger. He has what we call plot armor, right? He's not going to die because the book would be kind of over if he did. So the reader understands that at some sort of fairly deep level, they know Joe's not going to die. So it's very hard for me to put them in situations where they really feel Joe could actually die here. So what I did instead, I did try and put them in a few situations like that anyway. But what I did try and do is to put the characters around him in danger. So people he cared about. So that sense of danger, that sense of tension came from not from thinking, oh, Joe's going to die, because you know he's not, but Sophie might die. Joe's mother might die. The other characters might die. And that's absolutely valid. And in fact, a few of them do. And partly, I'll be honest, partly because I needed the reader to feel uncomfortable for the other ones. You kill one fairly important character, then everybody else is at risk, aren't they?
Yeah. So given too that it's CYA, you know, you must have had limits to what you could do to Joe and his colleagues. Like, there was kind of a limit to how much violence and things they could be exposed to. So I'm just wondering how you kind of negotiated all of that as well.
Yeah, it's weird, isn't it? Because, you know, violence now is fine, could do whatever I wanted, especially for the American version. But, you know, the other stuff, the naughty stuff, you had to be very careful. There is a mention of boobs. Joe is a 14-year-old boy. Part of the story was a coming-of-age story for Joe. Now, the fact that he's growing up during Second World War, the fact that he's undercover as a spy in France and Germany, that's part of the story. But he's actually developing from a boy into a man during this time. And, of course, he would notice things like boobs. Now, that, incidentally, the one mention of boobs that's in the series, which is in the first book, was taken out for the American edition. So it didn't make it that far. It was allowed in the Australian New Zealand version, but was removed. I think it was changed into eyes. He notices somebody's eyes instead of noticing their boobs. But, you know, this was intended to try and reflect what it's like to be a teenage boy growing up. These things are on your mind.
I don't know if you've seen, there's a doc, or not a, a series on Jeffrey Dahmer, the serial killer in the US.
Yeah, I did. Yeah.
I was like, the amount of violence in that and graphic detail about, you know, even seeing the cut up corpses and the rest of it. You did not see Jeffrey have sex.
No.
You know, you could not go there. They got out of bed with knickers on.
Yeah.
You know,
of course.
And,
yeah.
And I got to the end of it and I thought, well, did he have sex? You know, yeah. Did he actually have sex or did he just bring these people home? So yeah. It was such a distortion, you know, between the level of violence and the level of kind of any physicality. It was quite.
And in that series, that was an important part of the story. It's not gratuitous. It's not there for titillation.
I agree.
The viewer, and
it's part of his personality, which was, you know, a completely deformed personality, you know.
And in a sense, you know, with this Joe, I mean, that's a part of who he was as a kid, right? And yet I had to remove just about anything that tended in that direction, more so for the American version than for the initial imprint. So
interesting, given the pressure now for kind of all things to be all inclusive of diversity. How did you represent diversity within the text? I'm thinking of diversity in the broadest possible terms of race, gender, creed, LGBTIQA+, and even the one that dare not speak its name, class.
Look, with diversity, I mean, I think diversity is incredibly important in text today. When you're writing a historically accurate novel, then I think what's to me is more important is being historically accurate in terms of diversity. So the kinds of people that Joe meets in his journey and his adventures are the kinds of people he would meet in those places in that time. So in terms of a modern novel, it may not seem to be very diverse in the characters. Now, diversity, of course, for the Nazis was not a good thing. If you were different in some way or shape or form, then they possibly didn't like you. And an example of this, of course, is with one of the main characters, whose name is Sophie. This is explained in book two, but relevant in book three. She has a Down syndrome brother. And what the Nazis eventually do to her brother is part of her primary motivation for helping Joe in book two and book three.
So I grew up in Tasmania, so I'm just interested in how growing up in New Zealand, how you feel that informed your writing. Like in Tasmania, I kind of feel like I learned the value of the three W's of water, wilderness, and words. I'm just wondering how you feel, New Zealand informed your writing.
Yeah, it's a really good question. Probably a little bit of that sort of wilderness thing. I mean, New Zealand is a very small country. It's got a lot of bush. It's a very important part of the landscape and of the world of New Zealand. But the other thing that I'm not sure if it comes across that strongly in the Karapo Joe series is the sort of number eight fencing wire. Fix it with a bit of number eight wire. Is that an Australian thing as well?
You're probably talking to the wrong person, but
Kiwi ingenuity, and they basically say that you know, a New Zealander can fix anything with a bit of number eight fencing wire, and dude, whatever is at hand, you take it and you use it to do what you need. MacGyver could have been a great Kiwi, you know, he had Kiwi ingenuity. He could always take whatever is around and, you know, build a nuclear bomb or whatever he needed to do. So I think there's an element of that in just about everything I write, that my characters tend to have a little bit of Kiwi ingenuity, and that very much, you know, comes from the country and the nature of the people.
So what does a prize like the ARA Historical Novel Prize mean to you in a broad sense and a specific sense?
What it's all about is readership for me. The more people that read my books, the happier I am. For a variety of reasons, but, you know, including the fact that it helps my career and so on. But also, you know, I am trying to say things in these books, I'm trying to say things about the world that we live in today and to educate kids about where we got to, where we are now. Now, that makes the book sound like a history textbook, and it's not. It's an exciting adventure story. But through that adventure, they learn about the world. And I want them to do that. I really want kids to read my books for that reason, apart from any other reason. So, yeah, very much so.
So what's next? Is there a part four, or is this the end of the series? It does seem to allude that there is a part four.
Yeah, I left it just slightly open so that if we decided to go to part four, I had some hooks that I could pick up and take through. But reading the ending of, we're not going to give this away, we're not going to do any spoilers, but reading the ending of Wolf's Lair, there's sort of two ways of interpreting it. And one is it's a closing off of everything that's happened. And the other is that it's a starting of a new chapter of everything that's been going on. So if there is never a book four, then it was a closing off. And if there is a book four, then it was the start of the next part. But no, there kind of is a next book in the series, but it's just not really in the series. So in November, I'm off to Berlin for a year. I've got a writing residency there. And I will be writing a new novel that is set in the same universe. It's set 50 years, I think it is, after Joe's adventures in the Second World War. Joe appears in the book, but as an old man. And the book's not about him. It's about his grandson, who is 14. So set in actually in the year 1999, quite specifically, and for some specific reasons. But that is not a direct sequel, but a follow-on, I guess, from the Cutter Paul Joe series.
Right. So, yeah, as your career's kind of lengthened, you seem to be writing about older characters. Even Joe has kind of aged in the series. I'm just wondering if you'll ever write adult fiction and even go as far as, what broad changes would you make in the Cutter Paul Joe series if it was aimed at adults?
Yeah, would I write? I don't know. If I wrote an adult novel, I'd be starting all over again. I don't have any track record, so the chances of it getting published, I would be a beginner writer. Whereas if I write a young adult or middle grade or junior, then I've got a track record, and publisher will consider that when looking at whatever manuscript I send them. So I'm not sure I want to go and spend the time writing an adult novel that has a reasonably good chance of being rejected when I could use that same amount of time.
Yeah, but you were writing scripts and then you wrote a CYA novel and you got a career. So,
well, that's true. But I did think I found, my niche when I did that. So I think I'm in the right place. So I'm not sure. But I'll just say something a little bit interesting on that. The first book I wrote was definitely junior fiction. So that was age 8 to 12. And I have two daughters. And at the time, they both would have fit within that age group. The next book that I wrote was still junior fiction, but it just aged a little bit. It was sort of like a 9 to 13. And the next book I wrote was sort of a 10 to 14. And the books after that, they went into YA. And I didn't even realize it at the time, but I was following the age of my daughters, writing for their age level subconsciously, because I guess they were around me all the time. And that's the kids and the friends and the conversations they were having, I was hearing. So I was writing to that. But of course, Joe himself in the series ages, but that's just natural because it's spread over a time period in the same way that Harry Potter ages, because each book is a different year. So he has to get older and older. Well, Joe has to get older because, time is marching on as we progress through the war.
So, but just going back to my point, if you did change the novels to adult, what kind of things do you think you would have to change?
Yeah, I'm not sure. Certainly a lot of the stuff that I had to take out, but assuming that I kept Joe as a 14-year-old boy, but the book was written for adults, just to make that assumption, because, that's what the books were about. But yeah, his coming of age, I think I could go into a lot more detail about that side of his character and, what it's like to turn from a boy into a man, and particularly during that time. Violence was allowed, but boobs, a bit dodgy. So we could, revisit things like that. That would be quite interesting to do, but I'm not sure what else. I'd have to really rethink the whole series if I was trying to write it as an adult novel.
All right. Well, look, thank you very much for your time today. I've enjoyed our discussion. It was fun.
Yeah, it's great. And also, I just want to, thank the ARA Historical Society for being shortlisted for the award. It was a huge thing for me. I was absolutely rapt that happened, and that it makes my books a little bit more visible in Australia than they were before. That's fantastic.
Yeah, that's the main aim, I think, of it. It's great. All right, thanks very much for your time.
Thanks, Greg. Talk to you later. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to Imagining the Past, the 2023 season. Please remember to step back in time to our podcast archive, where you'll find interviews with many a luminary. Subscribe to the podcast series to be notified when new episodes drop. Also, visit our website, hnsa.org.au, subscribe to our newsletter, and join our Facebook group to be effortlessly up to date with all that's hip and happening in historical fiction. I'm Greg Johnston. It's so good to have your company imagining the past.